the brain perceives change as pain. So the same neurons and receptors fire when we're encountering a change in our environment, in our organization, as when we experience physiological pain. And that's a fact.
This is Neurofrontier. We bring you engaging and thought-provoking conversations with today's leading voices and emerging influencers in the neuroscience of leadership and change. You can hear more Neurofrontier podcasts on iTunes and read more on neurofrontier.com.
Barbara Troutline argues that just as we can measure our IQ, our EQ, and any number of our other intelligences, we can also assess our change intelligence. Barbara developed Change Intelligence Model, or CQ, as a tool to provide leaders awareness of their own change leadership style and the ability to adapt their style to be optimally effective in leading change across a variety of situations. I asked Barbara how we can use the CQ model to diagnose our change intelligence and how it can help us leverage our personal change leadership style to lead change more effectively than before. Barbara is a principal and founder of Change Catalysts, the author of the book Change Intelligence, Use the Power of CQ to Lead Change That Sticks, and the originator of the CQ Change Intelligence System. She has over 20 years' experience empowering people to achieve transformational, professional, and personal goals. I had the opportunity to attend Barbara's presentation at the 2013 PMI Global Congress in New Orleans. Her presentation was outstanding. She even received a standing ovation from the audience, which I have not seen happen ever since I started going to this event in 2006. I highly recommend Barbara as a keynote speaker. Here's our interview. Barbara, welcome.
Thank you. Thrilled to be here.
Tell us a little bit about your background and the work that you and your team do at Change Catalysts.
Sure. Well, I've been at this for 25 years. The main focus of my practice is to develop leaders and to manage change. I have a PhD in organizational psychology from the University of Michigan, and I've worked since the days of the Midwest Rust Belt. I'm located near Chicago, but you know, travel internationally. But in my early career, it was all about helping plants that were in danger of bankruptcy or in bankruptcy and to become more competitive. So worked on projects like Six Sigma, Lean Manufacturing, Total Quality, self-managed teams. Since then, worked on everything from mergers and acquisitions to reorganizations, new technology implementations, new manufacturing processes, HR systems. And I've worked with companies from BP to Wells Enterprises, GM, Ford, Whole Foods, healthcare systems like Ascension, Pharma, Baxter, Sears, Motorola, so a wide variety of clients over the last 25 years.
How did the idea of CQ come about, and what motivated you to develop the model?
Well, I've always had a passion for this area of developing change leaders and implementing change that sticks from my very early career, which was when I was a woman in my mid-20s, still in graduate school. I was, again, working in the Midwest, and my first stand-up consulting gig was in a steel mill, and they were in bankruptcy, actually. So I was standing up, I was introducing myself to a room full of about 25 steel workers, all men, all in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, and I was telling them how we were going to transform them to high-performance, total-quality, self-managed teams. And a 6-foot-5-inch, grizzled, 250-pound steelworker stomped to the middle of the room and said, "We're steelworkers and we don't listen to girls." So that was the illustrious start to my consulting career. And so we so often focus in change on the targets of change, on the fears and concerns and insecurities of the people that are going to be impacted by the change, like the steelworkers in that room, which is totally legitimate and understandable and what we should be doing. However, I knew from personal experience, and I know from the experience of coaching change leaders throughout my career, regardless of if they're in the C-suite or on the front line, that it can be equally, or if not more, intimidating to be the one standing in front of the room and delivering the message and accountable overall for the change process and to helping move people through it. So that's how the idea for CQ came about, is looking for a way to empower and equip change leaders to overcome the large percentage of failures that we see. I mean, there's been studies by McKinsey and others since the 80s that shows that major change fails 70% of the time. The needle hasn't moved on that in decades, so clearly there's something we need to do differently. And my focus is on empowering change leaders to lead differently so they're more confident and competent and we have successful and sustainable change.
And can you give us an overview of the model?
Sure, absolutely. Well, the definition of CQ, or change intelligence, is that it's the awareness of our own change leader style and the ability to adapt our style to be optimally effective, leading change across a variety of situations. So to break that down, it's the awareness. So it's all about understanding what our typical style is, our behavioral style, where we're coming from, and then the awareness of when we're using our strengths, when we're sometimes overdoing it, or maybe what our blind spots are, what we can do differently to be even more effective. So when you break that down in terms of the specifics, so that's the definition, the specifics of the model, is that it's a head, heart, hands model. So people tend to lead change either by focusing on the heart, the head, or the hands. If you are a heart-focused change leader, you tend to lead change by focusing on the people. That's what's on your radar screen. So you're very engaging, you're motivating, you're supporting, you're caring, you're like a coach. So obviously there's a lot of strengths with that style because one of the largest failure factors is the ability to rally people, overcome resistance, motivate people, encourage adoption. However, any strength overdone can be a weakness. So people who are very high heart sometimes can neglect to hold people accountable to high enough standards, encourage them with velocity and intentionality to alter their behaviors to be consistent with the change, give tough feedback for fear of disrupting relationships. Also, they can have blind spots. So sometimes being so focused on the people, they can drop out the goals of the overall goals of the change process. So that's the first style. The second style really does focus very strongly on the goals of the change process. They lead change with the head. So those folks are they're visionaries. They're forward-looking, future-oriented, strategic, big picture. They love scanning the horizons for new trends that are going to impact the business. However, in their zeal to move forward to new horizons, sometimes they look around and look behind them and realize that nobody is there. Because again, they can drop out the people. And they can also sometimes drop out showing people the plan, the how to get from here to there. So sometimes people may be very excited about their vision, want to work with them on it, but just not get how to do so. The last style, leading change with the hands, they are great at that how to. They love the plan, they're very process-oriented, very tactical, they're great executors, they typically make really great project managers. And leading change with the hands, again, we really need that. We need that executional focus, we need to make the changes real and get her done. However, sometimes those folks can lose the forest for the trees, they can forget about the big picture, the overall goals or vision, and sometimes they can overstep the need for positive team dynamics or taking into consideration people's emotions during the change process. So that's the basic model, a head, heart, hands model. And the idea is that we as change leaders, we tend to focus on one, maybe two. Some people are kind of moderate on all three. But that's what I do when I coach change leaders, is I help them understand, identify, become aware of their change leader style, and then coach them on leveraging their strengths and overcoming their blind spots.
I love the model because it does address some of the challenges that we face as leaders and as project leaders, in the sense that sometimes when it's stressful and when it gets to that point where it's really tough, we tend to default to one of these three dimensions and just basically lead just with that dimension versus creating a balance between all the three, the head, the heart, and the hand. Have you found that to be the case with some of the leaders that you coach?
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the biggest insights that people tend to have when they go through the process, is to see that so often what looks like resistance in other people is really that people don't get it, don't want it, or just can't do it. So that means that they don't get it. We haven't added enough head. We haven't given them the rationale, the business case, the bottom line need, the why, the what. We haven't painted the picture for them. Or they don't want it. They're either afraid of it. They don't have a sense of urgency. They don't get that it's necessary. They don't feel competent. There's barriers standing in their way. Or they don't know how to do it. They could be excited about it. They could really be bought into it. But we just haven't given them the training or the tools. Maybe their systems or processes or reward systems, communications, whatever it is in the way, and that's the hands. So often when it looks like resistance in other people, leaders find that it's a lack of certain change leader skills in themselves that they could easily add to their tool bag.
Have you found, Barbara, that there are also organizations that tend to favor or tend to reward leaders that have a strength in one of these dimensions versus rewarding and grooming and creating leaders that have a balance between all these three core dimensions?
Absolutely. I mean, I would answer that question in three different ways, actually. First, that as we know from psychology, that we tend to select people and promote people and reward people who are like ourselves. You know, we say oftentimes we give lip service to creativity, thinking out of the box, challenging the consensus, but a lot of times we kind of do the opposite in practice. That's just human nature. And so that's one. So we tend to see value in others, the traits and the behaviors we see in ourselves. So that's one. Second is that based on my research, because I do have an assessment that people can take to understand their change leader style, and based on the research results that I've collected, we do tend to see different types of change leaders at different levels in the organization. And perhaps not surprisingly, at the top levels, we tend to see more head-focused change leaders, the strategists, the visionaries. At the bottom, at the frontline leader level, we tend to see more coaches, more facilitators. So in a way, that's maybe contradictory to some people's expectations, but in a way it makes sense, because on the front lines, it's when people are transitioning from doers to delegators. They're needing to get work done through and with other people, so they need to coach them and support them. In the middle is where we tend to see the most hands-focused folks, the most executors, drivers, because I think at that point in their career, and project managers are like this as well, they're starting to be accountable to really drive results and get metrics accomplished and get milestones accomplished. So you can see that based on where you sit, a lot of times you may be expected to deploy certain behaviors and then rewarded for those behaviors and maybe even sanctioned for not deploying other ones. So that's another way to look at it that is kind of interesting. If, you know, a frontline leader is kind of attempting to be more strategic, more visionary, more head-focused, and not rewarded for that, rewarded more for keeping their heads down and focusing on the day-to-day. And the same thing at the strategic level. It's always great on an executive team to have a balance of people who we typically see so many more of the visionaries, the head styles, but of course to drive change through an organization, we need more of those heart-centered folks who are really thinking about soliciting the feedback from the people at all levels about how the change is being perceived and what the barriers they're facing and how the senior team can help them overcome it. And we definitely need people who are focused more on the hands, on the execution, because again, so much what we hear and see in change is the failure to sustain the change and to change the systems and the processes to be consistent with the change, and hands-oriented people focus on those sort of things. And the final thing I would say in answer to that question is that there's also some interesting gender differences when it comes to change leadership styles. And perhaps not surprisingly, men, regardless of hierarchical level, tend to focus more on the head, more on the strategy, the vision, the future, whereas women tend to focus more on the heart, the people, and have a strong secondary style. About a third of the women also focus on the hands, and so the execution. And so putting that together, men focus more on results, women on the relationships that facilitates results. And so that's, in a way, it's good news, it's bad news. It's good because it's consistent with other research in that people really like to, report to women leaders often because they tend, in general, statistically speaking, to be more people-focused, more relationship-oriented, more emotionally intelligent as leaders. There's a lot of other research that supports that on the whole in general. And women are very good about supporting their team, supporting their customers, and getting things done, really executing. However, on the negative side of that, as we've seen from Sheryl Sandberg's latest book, Lean In, we know that also, though, that women can engage in certain behaviors which may inadvertently, unintentionally hold them back. So if their heads are down, right, helping their team, supporting their customers, doing the detail work for the here and now, may not spend as much time looking up, looking around, looking in the future, thinking about how trends might impact the business, demonstrating their thought leadership, making time to, intentionally self-promote and promote their ideas and their thinking. So what happens at times is that when a man behaves contradictory to our typical stereotypes of men, when men behave more like coaches, right, or more like facilitators, more people-oriented, they might be negatively perceived and that might hinder them. And the same thing with women. When women are more visionaries and more drivers in leading change, they can also be maybe perceived negatively also because it's against our stereotypes of how women should behave. So that's the answer to your question from different facets, but definitely that there are institutional forces that do work to encourage certain change leader styles in certain levels and certain organizations and certain situations.
And I think the message there in the answer is the fact that each person, each leader must take responsibility of their own growth and development and be basically aware and conscious of their leadership style and be able to develop a more well-rounded approach because like we discussed before, is the fact that change requires a balance between all these three needs or all these three dimensions of change. So it goes back to the importance of professional development and self-development and awareness and being able to be mindful about how you lead. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And to build on that point, for example, I love what you said about being responsible for your style and how you come off to others. Sometimes people don't look at it from that perspective, but one of my other favorite change management consultants is a guy named Rick Maurer, and he writes a lot about overcoming resistance to change, and he says sometimes it's not that people don't get it or don't like the change, it's that they don't like you. sometimes it's us standing in the way of the change, and we don't even realize that. So for example, myself, my change leader style is called the champion style. I'm a combination of the head and the heart. I get where we want to go and get excited about getting there, and I lead change by facilitating and motivating and participating with the people to get there. So it's a champion style. I'm the opposite of the executor style, which is a high hand style. So I can, while it can be very motivating and engaging to some people, especially strong executors, who are maybe more moderately paced or maybe have a more staid focused or not as enthusiastic, I can come off as overly enthusiastic, even glib and even manipulative. So while my intention is to be motivating, my impact can seem manipulative and even superficial. So I have to be aware of that. It's not my intention. It's not my come from, and it's not my value system to be that way. But it can be the impact that I can unintentionally have by overdoing some of my strengths. So I think when people become aware of this, and it can really help them, again, be more effective across a variety of people and situations.
Because I do see this, that sometimes we go with what comes easy to us. And so if I'm very much comfortable in my default setting of being, for example, the drill sergeant, well, I'm going to apply my drill sergeant style, but that's going to be very limiting to how far I can go in my career, what kind of leadership projects or responsibilities or change projects and initiatives that I'm going to be called upon to lead. So it really goes back to that personal responsibility and being able to hone all aspects of your skills so that you can deal with these three. So I really appreciate this message that you did provide in the book as well as in your model. Can you speak to other aspects of the model that makes it different from other types of change models?
Sure, absolutely. Well, one reason that I developed the CQ system is that we do have thousands of books of change management and literature out there, and we do have a plethora of models and tools and toolkits. However, they focus mostly on the process of change. So things like the 7-step model, right, or things like a readiness assessment or stakeholder analysis or things like that. So very much on the process. And we also have tools that focus on the people impacted by the change. Like I said, the targets of the change. So things like Who Moved My Cheese help people understand their change friendliness and their change readiness. However, I did not come across a tool that really helped change leaders understand themselves and their change leader style. And I think that self-awareness is the first step to positively and impactfully leading a change effort.
Absolutely, because sometimes we forget that we are players in this particular change initiative, that our role does make an impact even when we are just facilitating, because we have our own unconscious sometimes agendas, and like Ron Heifetz calls them, our own hungers, right?
Absolutely, and so what you said also about the we're unaware, and so the drill sergeant will be the drill sergeant in every situation. And it's that old saying, you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. And as we know from neuroscience, that what happens in the brain when we encounter change is that the brain perceives change as pain. So the same neurons and receptors fire when we're encountering a change in our environment, in our organization, as when we experience physiological pain. And that's a fact. So we know that when we experience pain, we release stress hormones. And when that happens, when our brain gets on fear, our fear response, we know that less oxygen goes to our brain because we get in that fight, flight, and freeze mode. So our oxygen is going to our legs to help us run, or our arms to help us punch, or whatever those, you know, primitive reactions are. And so if we're not having oxygen going to our brain, and our higher thought processes are shutting down or not firing effectively, then what do? Then we deploy our well-learned, routinized responses. And so to your point, if we've always been a drill sergeant, and those are the only muscles that we flex, those are the neurological pathways that are going to fire when we're under stress in a change process. And how often in change are we under stress? And so the beauty of the CQ system and what I'm talking about in terms of being aware of your style and gaining the flexibility to adapt different behaviors is that you can retrain your brain, and you can, through practice, through building new habits, you can develop different pathways so you, even under stressful situations when you need it most, you'll have a much wider repertoire of tools in your tool bag, of behaviors to deploy, of communication strategies, of engagement strategies, of planning strategies, of all these different ways that you can reflect, and like you said, you can be mindful to bring to the change process, versus if you don't have that awareness and you haven't taken that time to intentionally practice and develop, and then you get in that, like we know in psychology, the threat rigidity effect. You perceive a threat and you get very rigid in your responses, and you see less, you physically see less, you see less possibilities inside, you get less creative, you get worse at problem solving, and making creative decisions and high quality decisions. You go by what you know, you go by those routines.
Talk a little bit more about what neuroscience tell us about how leaders can build these skills to help themselves and others through change.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's it right there. It's the recognition that what we know from neuroscience and from psychology, that change equals pain, that even the most change-friendly among us, and even positive changes, people will initially perceive it as pain, perceive it as a threat, perceive it as something to fear. So the first step is just the awareness, the acknowledgement that that is so, and we can have as much fanfare around a change as we want, but we need to understand that that's what's going on psychologically in us and in other people, and physiologically. And so it's the awareness, and then it's the awareness also that what our best strategy self-development-wise for ourselves is to... as we know from adult learning and neuroscience, that adults need to feel engaged in a learning opportunity. They need to have an intention for it. It's not like children in the classroom that will learn something to please the teacher. As adults and leaders in organizations, we need to have the will to build a skill. We need to have a purpose for it. So if we need to have an intention to develop our skills as change leaders, because we see that it's going to benefit ourselves, our careers, our teams, or organizations. So to set that intention to develop our skills, and then to very intentionally identify those specific new habits that we want to build into our repertoire, to be very intentional about that, to be as specific as we can. So to do a self-assessment, look at our strengths, where do we want to look at deploying them in a wider variety of situations that we've done in the past, so we can really leverage and build that way, kind of stretch ourselves, and build those muscles. And what are some aspects and positive behaviors of other styles that we either are uncomfortable with, we never thought of, maybe we don't even like, but we know that if we did them sometimes, if we had some more skill in them, more savvy in them, that would make us more effective overall. And then intentionally creating the intention to practice that and to look for opportunities where we can, if we're normally more heart-focused or big picture, to own the project plan. If we're normally owning the project plan, where can we step up and really facilitate the team meetings or lead the strategic retreat? So how can we, again, intentionally set our goals around self-development, and then put ourselves in situations where we can practice those skills so we can build those new neural pathways.
Barbara, you hold a PhD in organization psychology, and you conduct research on leadership and change management. What insights can psychology provide us about human reactions to change?
Yeah, great question. Many, actually. and some of my favorites is based on work by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. She was a researcher that studied people's reactions to death and dying. And so several change management consultants, thinkers, have related the stages that people go through when they learn of a terminal illness to when they pass. And because, of course, the stages that people go through and change, again, it evokes, at least initially, a lot of the same fear-based reactions. So when you link her model to the people's reaction to the change process, and I have a chapter devoted this in my book, is that you can look at people going through four main stages. The first one is denial. So oftentimes when people are confronted with the change, especially in the workplace, they deny that it's going to happen, or they deny it's going to impact that. You hear reactions like, oh, yet another program of the year, or we'll outlive this change, just like the last one, the last guy from corporate tried to shove down our throats. That oftentimes people just can't believe that another change is going to happen, or that if they just ignore it, it'll go away, or it won't really impact them. So that tends to be the first stage that people go through. The second change, then, once people appreciate and perceive that the change is really going to happen and it's probably going to impact them, tends to be some form of resistance. So that can take outright criticism. It could take passive aggressiveness. It could take the form of even sabotage. So it could be more overt. It could be more passive. But it's a very obviously uncomfortable position to be in. And it's when you see a lot of people's fears and insecurities come out. People fear losing status or skills or security. And so that's why there's so much been written about overcoming resistance to change, is because that can be one of the most difficult change stages for a change leader to help people progress through. Then on the other side of that, if people can get past the resistance, if a leader can help facilitate that, we tend to see the exploration stage. And at that stage, people tend to start looking at the change more positively than negatively. They tend to ask questions like, well, how can we make this work? Or let's try it. And you tend to see some creativity open up, some problem solving, some teamwork. People are kind of like sticking their toes in the water and testing things out. It can be a challenging change stage for team leaders, for change leaders also, because there's a lot of creativity, a lot of ideas abounding. There can be some chaos, confusion, which way do we go, what's the right next step? And so that can be positively challenging, but challenging and stressful nevertheless. And then finally is the commitment stage. So that's the nirvana stage of change management, where people are on board, they're engaged, they're adopting, they have some successes, they feel ownership over the change, it doesn't feel like pushing the string anymore, and it's starting to be embedded, integrated into how we do business. So those tend to be the stages that we see, especially major changes that people cycle through.
Can you talk a little bit about how your clients implement the model in their organizations? And can you touch on what type of changes the model is well suited for and type of results that you see your clients experience from implementing the model?
Sure, absolutely. Well, I've used the CQ system on three different levels of change. So at the individual level, coaching individual change leaders. At the team level, to launch new change teams or turn around struggling teams, and to do team building between teams in strife. And then also at the organizational level, so to look overall at a company's change leader capacity and change management tools and what systems that they have in place to really make change stick and sustain. So why don't I give you an example maybe of different industries in each one of those. Maybe that would be useful to your listeners. So I take the first one, an example of using the CQ system in when coaching change leaders is I've used it with Sears Holdings Company. They have a high potential technology leader program. So it's a leadership development program for high potential IT professionals from some of the best universities. They typically have master's degrees and 5 to 10 years of work experience. And they come in this program. It's a 2-year cohort model where they have certain classroom experiences together to learn different leadership competencies. And then they get placed in different business units across the corporation to seed best practices and great leaders. And so one of the competencies in their model is change management, and so they brought me in to use CQ to train their leaders in those skills. And so it's an exciting opportunity to use it in a situation like that because from my research, a lot of IT professionals, especially early in their careers, a lot of project managers, tend to be more hands-focused. They tend to be more focused on the details of the change, the requirements, the excellence of the system, and the testing and the troubleshooting and the design and the execution. Not so much heart-focused, engaging with the people at different stages along the process, or head-focused, thinking about how it really fits into the business and the strategy. So it's an interesting opportunity, especially for folks early in their careers at any stage, but early is good so they can have these tools ongoingly to think about. So, just one quick example from facilitating a process was a young guy, I'll call him Jared, that was in one of the sessions that he was kind of skeptical initially, a little cynical, mid-20s, and he said, he explained to us, because I always try to make it real and use real examples that they're dealing with, how to apply this. And he was sharing that he was responsible for a project to implement a new process to do special orders in the stores. And he said he was getting nothing but lip service from the people. and it wasn't moving forward. And so I asked him, well, what have you been doing to encourage adoption? And he said, you know, the usual, sending an email with the quick reference guide attached. And so his peers kind of, I kind of pushed back a bit and said, you know, would that really encourage adoption? Are there other things you can do? Like maybe go visit the stores, do some live training. And of course he pushed back saying there's no money in the budget for a boondoggle and I'm already on to the next project. But in the end, he did agree to do that. And so when he went to three stores in his region, the first store manager basically told him that was the first time that anybody from corporate IT ever visited. The second store manager told him, yeah, that he did see the email with the quick reference guide, but when he heard about he read about the new and different procedure, he read more and difficult and ignored it. And in the third store, he found that some of the clerks and the manager had actually tried to use the new process, but there was some design flaws that he was able to fix, and the quick reference guide was actually confusing from the eyes of the end user, so he was able to fix that too. So when he came back in the next session and told us the story, you could just see that he really had an epiphany, that he really saw that, you know, by adding more heart, by engaging the leaders and the people, he could have averted some problems early on by involving them, by testing, by engaging them sooner. And just by communicating, just building those relationships, building that goodwill, how that helped grease the skids for the adoption of the technology. And he also saw, he got some head skills as well, because he also saw how the system fit into the business of the stores, the work that the clerks were doing, the process that they used to engage with their customers. So we got a bigger picture view than just, quote unquote, implementing a new technology system. So I think that's a good real-world example about how, if you consciously think about why is my change project derailing, or why am I not getting traction, or why am I perceiving resistance, again, kind of looking at your change leader style and saying, am I really giving people what they need to get it, want it, and be able to do it? And just that simple thought process was very powerful in this particular instance.
The example is great because it comes from IT, which is my background, and there's nowhere this model is more needed than in implementing technology change initiatives.
Yeah, I agree. And of course, as a change management professional, I've worked on so many of them, and it's so challenging. I know, and especially as for folks who work on a more program or portfolio management perspective, and they're dealing with technology changes that have global implications and legacy systems, and a lot of investment in the old systems, and links to all kinds of business processes and people at all different levels and cultures. It's incredibly challenging and complex. So, and that's what my clients tell me, is that this is a simple model, but a powerful model. And again, you can use it like I did here at the individual level, but even this individual level coaching with this group had implications throughout the whole company, because when they got seated in the different parts of the organization, they were able to use the same language, so the same terminology. In terms of, are you dropping out the head, the heart, or hand? Very simple. And then also it's a very simple way for people to give each other coaching and feedback in a way that makes people much less defensive, because we do have this common language and common tool. And it is focusing on your strengths and how sometimes you overdo your strengths, and then also some blind spots that are relatively simple to shore up.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Once you recognize them and you're aware of them, and you put an effort in that deliberate practice, nothing can resist focus and concentration and change. And the challenge is that initial awareness.
Absolutely, I completely agree. And in a situation like this too, when you do it as a team level, and I can give you some examples for that if you want. But if you use this with an intact team or a project team, it shows what different people's change leader styles are. So it shows you the resources you have on your team and your strengths, and it also shows you as a team what you might drop out. So another example that I've worked with is Wells Enterprises. They make Blue Bunny ice cream. And it's a manufacturing unit, and they were embarking on a major change project that had a project team and a steering committee. And there were some issues between the two groups, and as they would tell you, because this is something that they talk about openly. They had, in the past, had a tradition of not the program of the year, but the flavor of the month, you know, the ice cream analogy, that they would have a lot of great ideas and projects going on, but they sometimes struggle to implement them. And so when we went through the process with the steering committee and the project team, realized that the steering committee, there were a lot of high head people, visionary strategists. They were looking to the future. They have a growth strategy. They want to, build their business and grow. And a lot of the project team members who were frontline supervisors, learning and development, human resource professionals, were more the hard-focused style. So the family-owned company in a small town, they were very engaged with their people, very cared about them, but sometimes shied away from really driving the change and accountability to difficult new behaviors or new behaviors because it was a change. And very few hands people, very few executors. So you can see just by the different change leader styles of the team, the steering committee and the project team, that there were some disconnects. And then also, because there's so few executors overall, there was, again, people getting excited by the strategy, people engaging with others to implement it, but a tendency to maybe drop the ball sometimes because there wasn't that focus on execution and the tactics and the plan and how specifically we were going to get it done in the follow-up. So again, it gave them a language that nobody's right, nobody's wrong. It's just something that was an honest missing. And we're just focusing on different aspects of the change process that are all important, but we need to get more consistent and aligned with how we're moving forward. And we need to either build these muscles in project management where we're weak, or we need to bring in people who have those kind of skills, which is what they ended up starting to do.
I think that's brilliant. As you were talking, I was writing myself a note to say that really it's providing the team a common language to hold difficult conversations or high-stakes conversations.
That's exactly right. And again, it makes people, it's a difficult conversation. People can get much less defensive than they would be otherwise because it is a strength-based model. And it is a behavioral model. So it's not like it's some personality defect that we're born with, right? It's very amenable to change.
It's amazing how that changes the dynamics of a team, by giving them that common language and that vocabulary to discuss things that are very difficult to discuss if they were just to be seen, like you mentioned, as a personality defect that they bring to the table. Tell our audience a little bit about your book, Change Intelligence, Use the Power of CQ to Lead Change That Sticks, and how your firm, Change Catalysts, can help their organizations with their change initiatives.
Thank you. Yes, I'm very excited. My book just got published in May, and it hit the Amazon bestseller list for its category, so it was very exciting. And I just love some of the reviews and endorsements it's received about how it's really helped people learn about themselves and also that it's actionable, because I wanted it to be both. I wanted to provide people with insights, new learning, but also be something that they could really apply immediately, and that's the feedback I'm getting. So if your listeners would be interested, they can go to my website, which is www.changecatalysts, so that's one word with an S, .com, and they can download two free chapters so they can check it out themselves. And in the book is a complimentary free CQ assessment. So, you buy the book and you can go online and the 20 simple questions takes 15 minutes. You get a customized report to download with your own change leader style. So that's kind of exciting. So at Change Catalyst, what we do is we coach leaders to be more confident and competent in leading change, so one-on-one coaching. We work with teams, so we help launch new project teams. We work with executive teams for strategic planning. We work with teams that are well-functioning to do team-building exercises, help with teams that are struggling or in strife. So we work at the team level and then at the organizational level. So we work with organizations that are implementing new approaches to change. Maybe like a lot of companies have project management offices. We're seeing a trend now to implement change management offices or change management communities of practice or centers of excellence. So I work with companies at a more system level to see how they could, improve or change their processes and offer people more, you know, more and better tools to manage change. And then I also offer a certification process. So if an independent or a coach or consultant that works for a consulting organization wishes to add this tool to their tool bag, they can get certified. And also you can bring it into your own organization and you can certify your project managers or your change management professionals or HR professionals, whatever part of your organization helps support change projects. Folks can get certified in the CQ system and then you can bring it into your company. So those are some of the varieties of services that we provide.
We've been talking to Barbara Troutline. Her new book is Change Intelligence, Use the Power of CQ to Lead Change That Sticks. And her website is www.changecatalysts.com. Barb, I really enjoyed our conversation. Please come back and talk to us some more. We look forward to having another conversation about your experience, how neuroscience applies to change, and all the new and exciting things that you're doing for your clients.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it as well.
You've been listening to Neurofrontier. You can hear more Neurofrontier podcasts on iTunes and read more at neurofrontier.com. Thank you.